hopeful passage of some difficult bills. And we begin this morning with Senate File 802, which is the public safety bill. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Higgins, I'm sorry, before you start, because I think you're going to propose this. We have a significant author's amendment which conforms the bill to – it changes the spreadsheet. And so we'd like to adopt that first, because those will be the numbers we'll be working from. So it's going to be a little bit more confusing to follow it. But this is the A9 amendment that's been distributed. And Senator Higgins, you want to just reflect what we're doing? I totally forgot that Senator Higgins moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
And then, Mr. Chair, the A9 amendment does some modifications of the numbers. We didn't get any more money or any less money, so it isn't that. One of the significant things we did was we put the stimulus funds all in the 2010 fiscal year rather than half and half, 10 and 11. And then on the back of the A9 amendment, we have at the very end of the bill, we have a licensure for firefighters. And we had taken the fees and put them in the general fund, and this puts them back to a special account that the department then can use to actually administer the licensure. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Okay. So we have the A9 amendment in front of us. Again, this allows the author to conform the spreadsheet with what she would like to do in presentation to us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, members, the biennial general fund-based budget for the Public Safety Budget Division is about $1.1 billion. After the cuts our division made, our base budget is now $1.036 billion. The Senate budget target required the Public Safety Budget Division to take a 7% general fund base cut. That amounted to $78 million. We then received $30 million in the federal stimulus money to backfill that $78 million. So that gave us a number of $48 million from the Public Safety Budget Division for the 2010 and 2011 biennium. Our tails target, however, remains at the $79 million level with the 7% cut, and you'll see in the spreadsheet we actually did that. You can imagine that cutting $48 million out of prisons and public safety is a very difficult thing to do. And as you can well imagine, the Department of Corrections has no say-so on who comes in. That is at the whim of people who commit crimes and the attorneys who represent them and the judges who sentence them. For the last several years, Minnesota has led the nation in the increased percentage of the number of people who have the increase in our prison population. It was 5.1% in 2008, the highest in the nation. We didn't feel that we could just say, do everything the same way that you now do it. And by the way, you know, you have a whole lot of money less to work with. The Senate determined that each division would receive a proportional cut. That 7% is reflected in this budget. You will also hear about some policy ideas that save us money. You may have heard about some of the policy ideas we were pondering in our division. We decided not to do some of them. We made changes to others of those ideas. I think that this budget that we'll be talking about today includes some thoughtful sentencing reform, making sure that the public continues to be safe and that our correctional workers are safe. And at the same time controlling the funds that we have to work with. Mr. Chair, I think I will turn it over to Mr. Turner. He will walk through the spreadsheet for you as well as Article 1, which is the language that goes along with the spreadsheet.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, members, let me explain the spreadsheet quickly. It has four columns. The first is the governor's recommendation for the 10-11 biennium. The second is the governor's 12 and 13 tails. They're here for comparison purposes. I'll be going over the third column, which is the chair's recommendation for the 10 and 11 biennium, and then we also have the chair's tails is the fourth column. For your convenience, on the right-hand side, we've got a number for each general fund line on the governor over or under the Senate. And if it's a positive number, the governor is over the Senate. Negative number, the governor is under the Senate. And then also, if you have any questions, on the left-hand side, I've got each line numbered, so for easier indexing. So I'll start on page one, line three. The Department of Public Safety, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management. It has a fiscal year 10 and 11 base budget of $5,028,000. The chair proposes a 7% base reduction of $340,000. The total appropriation for the biennium will be $4,688,000. Move down to the BCA, a base budget of $86,966,000. The chair proposes a base reduction of $5,644,000 for a total appropriation of $81,322,000. The fire marshal, which is a special revenue fund funded by the fire safety account, we have a base of $17 million. That varies from the governor's base of $16 million. The fire safety tax is bringing in more money than was estimated. So we list a base of $17 million. We take the extra million, transfer it to the general fund, and then leave the $16 million for the biennium to fund the fire marshal, the general fund transfer, and the fire safety board's firefighter education and training grants. Move to gambling and alcohol enforcement. Has a base budget of $3,370,000. Chair proposes a budget reduction of $236,000 for a general fund base of $3,134,000. I'd like to point out on line 36, there's a transfer from the alcohol enforcement account to the general fund. It was it's a governor's recommendation that that Chairman Higgins concurred with. This comes from the 2 a.m. bar closing account. It was originally transferred to the Trunk Highway Fund to fund increased enforcement. The language appropriating that money is no longer active, so the governor recommended transferring the money to the general fund as a general fund savings, and Chairman Higgins concurred.
So what was the account? You said the 2 a.m. bar closing.
Mr. Chair, if you remember when we passed the 2 a.m. bar closing, the governor, we imposed a fee on the bars who wanted be open that extra hour. Those funds were to be used to hire more law enforcement, especially at the 1 to 2 a.m., 1 to 3 a.m. hours. But what happened was that a lot of the bars said, 1 a.m.'s late enough to be open, and didn't ask for the extension, so the money didn't arrive, and the hiring of the new troopers didn't pan out in the way that it was expected. So now the money's just sitting there and not being used. So the governor recommended it to come over here for this.
So some bars paid in, and the money was not utilized. Is that?
Was any
Mr. Chairman, members, it's my understanding that the money was utilized for 2 years. I don't have the complete legislative history on this, but the appropriation language, I was told, is inactive now, and so the money has just been accumulating in the account. And what we've done, or what we propose to do legislatively, is to free up that money, transfer it to the general fund. Okay. That's my understanding.
All right, thanks. So I don't suppose we should try to keep bars open to 6 a.m. to help balance the budget. That wouldn't quite fit then.
Could be like New York. They have to close 1 hour a day or something.
Right. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, Moving to page 2, Department of Public Safety, Office of Justice Programs. They have a base budget of $74,396,000. The chair proposes a $4,964,000 reduction for a total appropriation of $69,432,000. Then we move on to the 911 Emergency Services slash armor. This is the statewide public safety radio system. This is all state government special revenue money. It's brought in from the 911 fee. We have a base of $121,782,000. There's two new expenditures this year, $5 million the first year for grants to local communities to assist them in hooking up to the emergency communications network. And then there's $3,431,000 the first year and $6,490,000 the second for the next generation 911 systems. Once again, there's no general fund money in there. That all comes from the 911 fee. That's the end of the Department of Public Safety. As you can see, it has a total general fund appropriation on line 61 of $158,576,000. Moving on to the Peace Board, Peace Officers Standards and Training, line 68. This is a special revenue account. Its base is $8,656,000. The chair recommends a cut of $606,000 for a total appropriation of $8,050,000. Private Detective Board, a base of $264,000, a cut of $18,000, total appropriation of $246,000. Department of Human Rights has a base, this is on line 80, a base of $7,168,000. The chair has a recommended cut of $500,000. For a total appropriation of $6,668,000. Page 3 is the Department of Corrections. Begin with the institutions. They have a base of $658,573,000. The governor recommended a reduction in dental services of $1,241,000. The chair concurred that recommendation. Then line 92 is the cut to corrections institutions to 7% base general fund base reduction. It's $38,590,000.
Okay. And Mr. Turner, before you go on to other line other lines in the budget. Let me go back to 89, the operational deficiencies, where the governor's requesting $19 million to fund deficiencies. Can I ask you how that was defined in the budget presentation, or Senator Higgins or Mr. Turner, as to how those deficiencies were defined?
That's just the first page, Chair. We can go get a budget book and
okay.
We can continue on, and we can come back to that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the next line is line 93. It's a $2.4 million cut. It's the description is a bit cryptic. It says, okay, Minnesota Correctional Facility Stillwater SEG Unit, Early Prairie Drawdown. What the legislature did last session, the last bonding bill, was give the Department of Corrections money to renovate the old or to build a new segregation unit. And they got it done under cost. So they have money the authority to, or they have the money allocated, but they don't have the authority to allocate it. In this year's bonding bill, on the Senate side at least, we give them the authority to use that money to renovate the old Stillwater SEG unit into general population cells. If that money is made available, we figure that that renovation will take place this summer, and it will allow the department to transfer inmates from Prairie Correctional, where we rent beds from a privately owned prison, to Stillwater. and we estimated that savings to be $2.4 million. I noted on the spreadsheet 7% general fund base reduction lines 88 to 90. Those three lines come to 7% of the institution's base budget. The next line, line 95, is the federal stimulus grant, $30 million appropriated in the first year, fiscal year 10, to the Department of Corrections. We have a total institution's general fund appropriation. It's lopsided because of the $30 million in the first year, $293 million in 10 and $323 million in 11. The next line shows the $30 million federal money only in the first year. We move on to community services. That division has a base budget of $231,624,000. The governor recommended the elimination of restorative justice grants, 8-day hold facilities, of which there are four, and day reporting centers, and that would save $1,536,000. Chairman Higgins concurred with that recommendation. In addition to total the $7 million cut, or the 7% cut, excuse me, on line 109, the chair recommends cutting an additional $14,320,000 from the Community Services Division for a total appropriation of $215,768,000. Finally, we have operations support, a base of $46,298,000. The chair recommends a cut of $3,080,000 for a total appropriation of $43,218,000. And I guess if, do we want to discuss the governor's operational deficiencies?
When Alice gets back with the book.
Well,
we'll get the book and just go ahead and set some
guidelines. Well, Mr. Chairman, and members, I can, you know, more or less detail it. Most of it is salary, and the department had a $10 million, or reported a $10 million deficit a year ago. Request any money last year. They closed that. It looks like they're going to close that deficit successfully by imposing a hiring freeze, an inessential travel freeze, and keeping a number of positions open. I think it was 94 positions that have been attrited in that time.
Well, is there anybody here from the agency? I've got the budget. Mr. Mossman, pull up the budget page for me. Is there somebody from the agency who can help me out a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Christ. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Facilities Division of the Department of Corrections. And Mr. Turner has described essentially correctly what the issue is in the deficiency that the governor is recommending. It's increased wages due to contract settlements, higher insurance costs, other items such as pension obligations. In addition, there were unrealized bed savings from less double bunking at the Stillwater facility. We attempted to double bunk about 360 beds in that facility. We found that there was a big increase in violence in that living unit, so we backed off on that so that we could have a peaceful, safe living unit there. So that was the only other initiative that contributed to that.
Okay. So let's try to distinguish between the two. The request in the governor's budget was almost $20 million. Of the $20 million, how much of that was the bed savings portion?
The double bunking part?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was 13.4 million.
Okay. And so 6.5 million, I mean, give or take, 6.5 million came from negotiations, insurance, and what, health benefits?
Insurance, pension, pension obligations.
Okay. So why does this particular agency show up with those deficiency costs, and we haven't seen that throughout all the other agencies?
Mr. Chairman, I can, I guess the way I would answer that is that we operate 24/7 agency. We've got to man posts, and those are obligations that can't be avoided. Perhaps other agencies can cut positions.
So it's a question of, so it's not a question of health benefits, negotiations, and pension benefits. Because my question is, I mean, that would be, if in the course of negotiations, you have 100 FTEs, and you've got to pay health insurance for those folks, and normally we see that, we don't see the health insurance costs carried through the agency budgets. We see them across state government. I'm still not quite sure why that couldn't have been determined at the front end and why it shows up as a deficiency at the back end.
Mr. Chairman, those contracts weren't settled until after our budget was settled.
That's true of every other agency.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. We are simply pointing out what our obligations are and the fact that our budget did not conform to our obligations.
We're kind of going around in circles a little bit, and so I appreciate your help, but obviously in corrections, you have a unique workforce. You know, I don't mean to pick on Commissioner Badgerow, who's sitting there, who does a very good job. We assume her employees are not there at 2 in the morning. Maybe some of them are occasionally. She's saying yes, but that's not an agency where you're going to have the unique kinds of staffing needs that you would have within a prison. So certainly corrections is unique in that respect. But in the same way, whether it be the Commissioner of Administration or the Commissioner of Human Services, Commissioner of Human Rights, whatever it is, they would know at the front end, here are the needs we have in our agency. We know we're going into contract negotiations. And so I'm trying to figure out why this particular agency shows up with an operational deficiency for these kinds of costs, which are not insignificant. You suggested $6.5 million. When, unless there was going to be some, and I haven't heard from you or anybody else, unless there was some totally unexpected increase in prison population, where all of a sudden there was just a flood of prisoners coming in this past biennium, totally unexpected when we finished the session and the budget 2 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly not trying to be evasive. I'm trying to give you the best answer I can here. And with the information I've got at hand, I would just say what I've said before. We are, the contracts were concluded after we got our budget. We made it through the first year of the last of this present biennium. We had a $10 million deficit that we're attempting to make up, and I think we'll make up successfully in this fiscal year. All of that carries forward for us and accounts for the items in our deficiency. If I can get you better information from our finance staff who aren't present this morning, I'd be glad to do that, sir.
Well, I certainly think as we go into the conference committee process, Senator Higgins, I hope we do get the better information because, again, my concern is that what you're describing, and again, I'm not arguing the point that there are not some unique employment situations within the Department of Corrections, nor am I arguing that there are not some unique safety considerations for correctional officers within the Department of Corrections that arguably are not there for the other agencies. What I'm suggesting is that was all known 2 years ago, and that you're no different than any other agency in terms of going into contract negotiations, understand the unique needs of your agency, and so on. That's why I can't quite figure out A to B to C. I think Sarah Berglund had a question, but the other comment is that Sarah Berglund, and to a lesser extent myself, went kind of around in circles relative to the Department of Human Services with a deficiency request they had this year. Now, that related to the sex offender program, and that did relate to a significant increase in population and so on. Now, we had other concerns, but they also showed up with a deficiency request in this year's, which we passed, as opposed to kicking it into the next year's budget. So that's a second question I have. But Sarah Berglund, I think you...
I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with how much overtime you're authorizing in your agency.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we try to absolutely minimize overtime in our agency. I think overtime is a controllable expense, and we don't hire overtime any more than we absolutely have to. I was the warden at Stillwater for 6.5 years, and we lowered overtime from about $400,000 a year to about $100,000 a year when I was there. When I was the warden at Lionel Lakes for 4 years, I did a similar thing. The overtime in that facility is down to from about $200,000 a year to less than $100,000, about $90,000 a year. And I've had conversations with all of our present wardens about overtime being a controllable expense, about minimizing that as absolutely as they can by changing inmate programming, by not staffing certain posts, by moving staff around in the facilities, by anticipating vacancies and anticipating overtime if necessary and doing everything they can to control that.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Christ, you're not answering my question. I'm asking you how much was in your budget during this period of time that you were in a deficiency operating mode for overtime.
Senator Higgins, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be evasive. I can get you the exact number, but I don't have
it
in
front of me. I'd like to know the number, and I'd like to know what it was the previous biennium.
Mr. Chairman, yes, ma'am.
And Mr. Christ, I would second Senator Berglund's question, and I hope, and I'm going to suggest certainly present the information to Senator Berglund myself, but first present to Senator Higgins, because when we get into the conference committee process, and we know what we're going to hear from the governor, you can't touch the corrections budget, and we've got this deficiency and all the rest of it. And I'll be honest, this is not meant to be any reflection on what happens within the agency, again, the unique nature of the agency, the work that you individually or collectively are doing. But when we see this is a relatively unusual budget line item, operational deficiencies, $20 million. And when you suggest that among the reasons for the deficiency are, and I have another question about the other part of it, are costs that every other agency seemed to have taken into account at the front end of the process, and we don't see the same kind of deficiency request from them. And then you suggest, in terms of overtime, you've cut down overtime. So if you had said, well, we had riots breaking out, and we had a shortage of guards, and so we started paying, 10 times what we'd expected in overtime, you're not suggesting that. So, I can't speak for Senator Berglund, but I'm not hearing an explanation that's satisfactory. The other issue you raised is this question of double bunking, and I think that's very interesting because wasn't this discussed then in 2003 initially, conversion to a double bunking system?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct.
You know, that's really interesting. Governor Plenty comes into office in 2003, and I don't know that Governor Plenty presented this that I can recall. Certainly we heard it from the majority in the other body about, you know, we're going to double bunk and triple bunk and quadruple bunk these prisoners, and that, you know, they shouldn't get all the benefits of, you know, living at, you know, the Westin Hotel in downtown Minneapolis. And so it makes for easy political rhetoric. So we go ahead and do some of that, certainly signed by Governor Plenty. And guess what? It doesn't work. The question I think that's just that's very interesting, that now Governor Plenty's administration is backing away from what was utilized in 2003. Separate from that, though, that was 2003. Today is 2009. So has it taken 6 years to realize that this double bunking didn't work and that we would have to convert back to single bunking, and all of a sudden it shows up in, you know, this past biennium or this past year as opposed to 2003, 2004, 2005?
Mr. Chairman, we started double bunking shortly after 2003, and we gave it our best effort to make it work because we knew that finances were attached to it. We got to a point in 2005 and 6 and 7 and 8 where it just became untenable in that living unit, in that facility. We had a number of staff assaults as a result of that. We had a number of small disturbances in that cell hall as a result of that. That cell hall had an inordinate amount of lockups in order to regain control of that while we were figuring out who the troublemakers were and getting them out of there. And it was in this present biennium that we started to back off of that initiative in order to bring some order and safety back into that living unit.
Thanks. And Senator Higgins, I know we have a lot of other work to do with your bill, so I'm not going to belabor this any further other than to say, Mr. Christ, I find that the explanation of that part of the deficiency more acceptable than the first part, where you're saying this is kind of a cumulative effect of the double bunking, that you didn't see everything, you know, October 1st, 2003, that this gradually became clear. So the lesson is not to the Department of Corrections at all in this respect. This is a lesson to every politician at this table, that when you start engaging in demagoguery on these kinds of issues, there are significant financial and other consequences to what happens with our state budget and our state public policy. So it's a lesson to be learned by all of us who are so inclined. Senator Berglund has been doing backflips over this past year relative to what's happened with the sex offender program in the Department of Human Services, and now we find that the Department of Corrections is forced to do somewhat the same because of politicians who think they know a lot more than the reality of what's happening in the criminal justice system. But that's enough for my speech this morning. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just would like to mention that we are double bunking sex offenders in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Mr. Chair.
Interesting. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, we our department asked for more information about the security threats, you know, because we were really worried about you know, the employees who work there, and we got an amazing page from the department saying that, I'll give you a couple of statistics. As of February 6th this year, we had 9,709 offenders incarcerated. And of those, let me see, that would be all but 6,800 of them were considered a security threat to to the rest of the population and to the employees. That's defined as, you know, the gang criteria that they set out. you know, some of them meet, you know, multiples and multiples of that criteria. Some of them are considered inactive. Maybe they've gotten too old to get all, you know, all wound up. But they, you know, they're a difficult population for our employees to work with, and double bunking them, as we have seen, makes it more difficult. And so we didn't take any savings in this budget that we're proposing to again impose more double bunking. We've learned that, as you said, even though we can talk a good game about being tough on crime, what happens is that it is a security threat to our employees.
But that's the whole point. This wasn't tough on crime.
No.
This was politics. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I didn't understand the 6,800 figure that you gave us. Is the 6,800 the...
Did I read that right? I think you said it. I said it the wrong way. Is that what I did? Would you go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, I believe out of a total of 9,700 offenders, about a third of them are identified as being... it's having some gang activity during the course of their incarceration. So 6,800 are not gang involved, but still a significant portion, over 3,000, are gang involved in our facilities.
And Mr. Chris, they're the dangerous population, or they're generally part of the most dangerous population?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, I think that's safe to say that they are part of the most dangerous part of our population. I would point out that we've got a highly distilled criminal population in our correctional facilities, with 97,000 or 9,700 people locked up in Minnesota. Just as comparison, Wisconsin locks up about 26,000. And so it's a pretty distilled population. I would say they're all dangerous at some level. These 3,000 are among the most dangerous.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, one other quick question about double bunking. Has double bunking been successful at any percentage, or what percent are successfully, or how many are successfully double bunked?
Most of us are. Most of it's double bunked.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, probably 65 to 70% of our department is double bunked, but most of that, half of that, happens at lower security levels, medium custody, minimum custody. We still do have double bunking at Stillwater in that living unit, just not as many fellas as we anticipated. We've got double bunking at St. Cloud. All of our Rush City facility is double bunked except for the segregation unit, but it was designed to be double bunked with cells that were larger than the 60 square foot cells we've got at Stillwater and the 48 square foot cells we have in places at St. Cloud.
Thank you.
What about Lino?
Mr. Chairman, Lino Lakes is, with the exception of 42 cells in their segregation unit, is entirely double bunked.
Yeah. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, at the beginning of your presentation, you used a percentage, 5.1%, and I think that was in relation to how fast our population is growing. Tell me again what that number meant.
The increase in the prison population. Thank you. In 2008 was 5.1%, which is the highest in the country.
Well,
and has been for the last several years the highest in the country.
Mr. Christ, I appreciate the help with this, and again, I don't, but I am struck, and let me make it clear, this is not, I don't know you, but I know of your reputation when you were a warden and the exemplary work you did as a warden. And I think most people have that understanding of you know what you did in that capacity. So this is not in any way directed toward your professional ability, but it's directed, like I said, at politicians. I don't want to carry on because Senator Higgins, you want to get back to your bill and the rest of it. But I think this is a very important consideration, this bill, because we know that this is a place of difference with the governor in terms of what we do with the corrections budget. And it's not going to be an insignificant issue when we get into the conference committee process. So when we talk about double bunking and my concern is these considerations were all raised. All the things we've been talking about in terms of what was going to happen, all of this was predicted when this was discussed back in 2003, every bit of it. And obviously people who show up in Stillwater are not exactly model citizens. That's the problem. I mean, I was once double bunked, and it worked out fine. That's when I was a freshman in college. Although we had a couple of people on the dorm floor who weren't model citizens either. But when you take folks like the Stillwater population, those are some pretty tough characters. And so this was all predicted. And now we're faced with this kind of a budget deficit generally, and I don't blame the governor for the enormity of the budget deficit, but it's exacerbated by this kind of politicking. So thanks, Mr. Crist, and Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, you talked about the 5% increase or 5+% increase the last few years, and yet now Mr. Crist referred to the fact that we were that much further behind Wisconsin in terms of the numbers we incarcerate. Where do we rank nationally in terms of our on a comparable ratio of our incarceration?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it's difficult to compare. We are at 9,709 or whatever that number is. We are 49th out of 50 states in the number that we incarcerate. However, we have an amazing system of community corrections here in the state. We have 147,000 people currently in that system. So if we combined the two together, we'd be at like eighth from the top. When you take the community corrections out and we only talk about the people who are incarcerated, we are way at the bottom.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, when you do that combined number, are you doing that comparably with what other states also do on a community basis?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Wisconsin, for example, is just now starting to look at a community correction system. So they really do have a huge population that is incarcerated. And they're actually looking at Minnesota to see how we do it. Periodically, I get phone calls from legislators who are in Wisconsin who I've met at conferences and things going, how do you guys do that? How do you only have that many people? And so then, you know, we have a conversation about the whole community corrections process and how that supplements our system in a way that we keep the worst people in prison and then we work diligently in the community otherwise. I think someplace up in my office I have a Pew Center for whatever they're called, the Center for Research, the Pew folks, and they've done a lot of studies lately on correction systems around the country, and I'll be happy to share those with you if you'd like to look at them.
Mr. Chair?
Wilson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I noted, I think somewhere in here you have also reduced the percentage of term down to 60%.
Yes.
So I presume that is going to add more to the community corrections or to the probation officers and load at the county level. Is that taken into consideration at all in terms of how that is it just a shift of burden to the counties that that will relieve the pressure on the state, or how is that being handled?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, some of the counties use the corrections. We have basically three community corrections systems. Is that right? The Community Correction Act counties, the... Go ahead.
I would defer to Ken Mers.
Mr. Mers, are you around someplace? And then the other one that I forget the name of that Mr. Mers will know, and then many counties actually use the corrections department staff to do the probation. So Mr. Mers will give you the real detail.
Mr. Mers.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Mers, and I'm with the Community Services Division of the Department of Corrections. For supervision in the community, there's basically, as Senator Higgins said, three different systems that are used. The first is the Community Corrections Act counties. They do all of the corrections delivery in their areas. There's currently 17 jurisdictions comprised of 32 counties that are under the Community Corrections Act. In the other 55 counties in the state, the Department of Corrections is responsible for supervising all of the felon offenders on probation, as well as all the supervised releasees, all of those people who are released from prison and are under supervision. The county probation officers are responsible for supervising all juveniles and all adult misdemeanant offenders in those 55 counties. Where the third system comes into effect is that the counties then, if they choose, they can contract with the Department of Corrections to provide that juvenile and adult misdemeanant supervision also. So in 27 of the 55 counties, we also, through a contract with the county, provide the supervision for juveniles and adult misdemeanants.
So, and Mr. Chair, I would assume that the counties of are participating in the Community Corrections Act are likely to be the most populous counties and therefore probably have the heavier load. I'm still wondering what the impact is of shifting that length of sentence. Obviously, it's very expensive to keep them in prison, but there, it's not a no-cost somewhere else in the system. Does our budget, does your budget reflect in any way any assist for that change to the counties, or is that just a property tax burden?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, you're correct. The Community Corrections Act counties are primarily your metropolitan area counties. That, in fact, with the number of offenders under supervision, they supervise approximately 70% of the offenders. Currently, through there is a subsidy program that there is the Community Corrections Act subsidy, which provides assistance to those counties for their correctional services.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, is that amount going up in this budget, or is it being cut as well, or staying stable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that goes down by 7% like everything else in this budget. Not a perfect budget I have.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ms. Mers, Mr. Chris. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before they leave.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Day.
Just a couple quick questions. In that Faribault, which is in my district, and it's a brand-new prison, what percentage of that prison will be double-bunked?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, nearly 100%. We are moving the population of that facility from the old state hospital buildings into four what we call a cave building, where each building has 416 offenders and each cell is double bunked in that. There might be a couple of living units of the old type, but I believe those are double bunked as well.
Mr. Chairman, and the reason I mention that is because I'm one of those double bunk guys that you were talking about. And you can see we're building a brand new facility that we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to build, and they are double bunking. And that's how it was built. And that's going to save us a huge amount of money in years. But the next question I have, and this is just an estimate, tonight in Minnesota, how many people will we have locked up compared to Wisconsin? Because I see our state prisons, there's already a 16,000 difference between what we have locked up in our state prisons compared to Wisconsin state prisons. Do you have any estimate of that? I know you don't have to be totally accurate, because how would you know, but overall.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, I would say again, we've got about 9,700 offenders locked in the state prison system in Minnesota. Wisconsin has in the neighborhood of 26,000-27,000.
And Mr. Chairman, do you have any idea of how many they have locked in jails and we have locked in local jails?
Local jails.
Mr. Chair and Senator Day, we have approximately another 9,000 basically offenders that are locked up in our local jails, our local county jails in the state of Minnesota. And I believe in Wisconsin, it's pretty much the same ratio as they have. If they have twice as many in their prison system, they also have about twice as many in their local jails also. So what I would say is our local jails pretty much operate the same way as our prisons in Minnesota, where we use them strictly for the most dangerous offenders.
And, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I was trying to get at is that we are 48th incarceration per capita, because we now just compared Wisconsin, and that would tell you that our numbers are accurate when it comes to Wisconsin. They're probably accurate when it comes to Vermont or New Hampshire or whoever. So, yeah.
And obviously, I started the conversation, and so probably unfair of me to try to end it so we can get back to Senator Higgins' bill. But, Senator Day, I am forced to make one small comment. If you've been a proponent of the double bunking, the testimony from Mr. Crist is that double bunking, it's not that double bunking doesn't work, that depending on where it is, it can work, but it's not one size fits all. I think that would be a paraphrase of Mr. Crist's testimony.
Mr. Chairman, and that's exactly why a lot of us wanted double bunking, so we got at least a high percentage of people going that direction. And granted, if along the line there's a 25% that can't be double bunked or whatever, fine, but at least 75% can. And that's much better than having 100% that we don't have double bunked.
Okay, fine. And there's some middle ground, except those concerns were raised 6 years ago that you could make it work some places, not places, and not other places, and we are now facing the cost of that now. So if one last
Chairman,
comment.
The things around here are done by us. I mean, the governor says no new taxes. If we all want taxes, then we're going to vote in taxes and do whatever we want. The governor can say what he wants and whatever. We're all sitting here, and we keep saying, well, the governor's forcing us to do this. The governor's forcing us to do that. No, we vote the bills in. The governor doesn't vote nothing. He's down in the office probably in Brainerd today or someplace out talking to a Rotary Club or something. We're sitting here today making bills, and we're the ones that run the state. Anyway, we can't keep blaming it onto the governor.
I just have to suggest members in concluding. I'm not sure if Senator Olson had a comment, but when Senator Day came on the committee this year, a couple of people said, well, do you want Senator Day? I said, absolutely want Senator Day. I always look forward to listening to Senator Day under any circumstances.
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of people that go through life being very politically correct, and they never want to say anything to bother anybody or whatever, and sometimes I wonder, why are you here?
And Senator Day, I told that to one of our new caucus members yesterday when you were speaking on the floor. I said, listen, we really miss him. Senator Olson.
Well, you know, if double bunking worked all the time, we wouldn't have the divorce rate we have either.
Okay. I think that's in another bill. Senator Higgins, thank you, Mr. Crist and Mr. Mers, for the serious part of the conversation.
Mr. Chair, here's a couple of more statistics for you. Louisiana is number one in their incarceration rate. They have 37,540 people in prison. We're 49th at 9,400 and whatever. Wisconsin's right in the middle at 27th incarceration rate at basically 24,000 people. And the other statistic that I thought you might be interested in is that since 2000, we have increased our offender population by 2,948 people. So
since what year?
People who are leaving and the people who are coming in, there's a net gain of almost 3,000 people since the year 2000.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Dave.
We're not doing it.
Well, the state of Minnesota, we're not putting,
you know, people are doing it, and we're sending them to prison.
Oh, yeah.
And personally, I wish we sent more.
Okay. Well, I started this, but Mr. Turner,
okay,
wherever we left off.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, members, quickly finish the spreadsheet here. We're on page 4, Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It has a biennial-based budget of $1,218,000. The chairman recommends a reduction of $68,000 for a total appropriation for the biennium of $1,150,000. That's the end of the divisions with the agencies within this bill. I'll go over a few revenue transfers that are within the bill. We've got a general fund transfer in from the special revenue alcohol enforcement account. We spoke about that in the Department of Public Safety. And the general fund transfer in from the fire safety account with the fire marshal. There's a transfer into the general fund from the special revenue account because of the post board cut. The post board is a special revenue agency. It's got a cap on what we can appropriate. If we cut that cap, that money flows into the general fund and it's a savings. And then something that I'll talk about as I go through Article 1, we have a general fund transfer in from the Minnesota Correctional Industries Revolving Fund, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And finally, between the cuts and the other fund adjustments, we come to our target of $1,036,862,000 and a tail target of $1,050,445,000.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, coming to the end, I heard, because I was moving around here, I heard, but I didn't hear the end of it, the earlier comment about the governor's having cut the restorative justice program. Did you agree with that? Because I don't see anything specific, and your spreadsheet doesn't cover everything. So.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it's on line 107. We agree to
here.
That cut.
Oh. Okay. That's too bad.
Yeah, I agree.
If we're
like
trying
I said,
to,
I have no good options in this
If we're
bill.
Trying to keep people from coming back.
Senator Foley, in his bill that we'll be hearing tomorrow, has restorative justice items in it.
He does.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Higgins.
Who's here tomorrow?
Monday. Not tomorrow. Sorry.
Tomorrow.
They're all blurring together.
Thank you, Senator Vestal.
Mr. Chair, I think at this point we'll start through the actual language of the bill. Article 1 has some riders that will explain some of this as well. Mr. Turner will go through that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Turner.
And members. Article 1 reflects the spreadsheet, but it also contains some riders for the individual agencies. I'll go through those very quickly. Section 1 of the article is the summary of appropriations by fund. Section 2 just explains the format of the bill. It's not until Section 3 that we actually get to an agency, and the first agency is the Department of Public Safety. Subdivision 1 reflects the total appropriation, but it also has a number of agency-wide riders. The first starts on 2.18. This is a rider that we've included in the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Corrections. It reads, by January 1, 2010, the commissioner must reduce the department's fleet of cars by 20%. The next rider, starting on 2.21, is a rider that is salted throughout the bill in each agency. It's a prohibition on the use of appropriations. It reads, no portion of this appropriation may be used for computer, telephone, motor vehicle, or technology purchases or upgrades, or for new leases on these on those items, or two, out-of-state travel that is not directly connected with and necessary to carry out the core functions of the department. And then in the end, the last sentence says, you know, however an existing lease on an item described in that clause, in this clause, may be renewed. That rider is attached to every agency throughout the bill. The next rider for the Department of Public Safety reads that the commissioner shall consider discontinuing the practice of entering into agreements with the Office of the Governor to pay personnel costs of policy advisors to the governor. That rider is also in the Department of Corrections. The next rider would be under the Fire Marshal, 3.17 to 3.21. That's the transfer from the fire safety account to the general fund account that I discussed when we were going over the spreadsheet. Then you move down under alcohol and gambling enforcement, starting on line 3.26. That's the 2 a.m. closing fee. The account, this language transfers the money into the general fund. We discussed that earlier as well. Then on page 4, under the Office of Justice Programs, we have a standard cut on administrative costs up to 2.5% of the grant money may be used to administer the grant programs. Then a fairly important rider, 4.12 to 4.16. We cut the Office of Justice Programs by $4+ million. This rider states that the commissioner shall prorate the base cut to the Office of Justice Programs using the various, among the various programs and grants funded by the office, based on their current portion of the office's base budget. Just a straight line cut to each grant and state program. The next rider has to do with federal stimulus money. The Department of Public Safety will be receiving over $30 million in federal stimulus. Some of it is already directed, and some of it is will be out for competitive bid. Senator Higgins' bill states that it's her wish that they give priority to three areas. The first is organizations that provide mentoring grants for children of incarcerated parents. The second is youth intervention programs. And the third is reentry programs for offenders. That's the end of Office of Justice Programs riders. Starting on page 5, we have the 911 Emergency Communications Network. These riders all delineate how we spend the 911 money. They're identical with the governor's recommendation. Go over to the post board, page 6. We have the post board special revenue appropriation cap that I think I explained earlier. The training reimbursement cap, this just reflects the cut of $606,000 to the post board. Then again, we have the lease purchase travel rider that I explained. Private detective board, we have the identical lease purchase and travel rider. Human rights, we have the identical rider. And we come to the Department of Corrections. 8.21 to 8.23 is the car fleet rider. By January 1st, 2010, the commissioner will reduce the department's fleet of cars by 20%. Then we have a rider that's specific to the Department of Corrections on staff consolidation. Starting on 8.25, the commissioner shall consider consolidating staff from correctional institutions in geographical proximity to each other to achieve efficiencies and cost savings. Staff considered for consolidation must include wardens, deputy wardens, and human resources, technology, and employee development personnel. And it continues, the commissioner shall consider consolidating the department's human resources, technology, and employee development functions in a centralized location, and discontinue the department's practice of annually having a warden monitor the legislative session. And finally, as the Department of Safety, Public Safety, we recommend that the commissioner should consider discontinuing the practice of entering into agreements with the Office of Governor to pay personnel costs of policy advisors. Then, once again, we have the prohibition on use of appropriations, lease or purchase of computers, telephones, motor vehicles, etc. No out-of-state travel is not directly connected, and existing leases may be renewed. Then a fairly important rider on 9.25 to 9.31 states, when allocating reductions in services and programming under this appropriation, the commissioner will not make reductions to inmate educational programs, chemical dependency programs, or reentry programs. I think between the three of them, that comes to between $17 and $19 million. The next rider, 10.5 is simply the federal stimulus money, $30 million the first year. It appropriates that money. We have on 10.11 to 10.15, we have the transfer from the Minnesota Correctional Industry Revolving Fund to the general fund, $1 million each year, and the tails on that are zero. Then community services, starting on 10.20, this is, it just states, it's current law. The Senate position is that the counties retain jurisdiction of short-term offenders. the governor shifts that jurisdiction back to the state, and with that shift back to the state, the governor appropriates an additional $9 million.
That we don't have.
Correct. So Senator Higgins' position is current law. The $1.6 million each year is what's in the base, and that comes to about $9 reimbursement per day for the counties. Then finally, 11.6 to 11.13, the commissioner shall prorate the general fund base reduction of $14.3 million to community services among the following three budget activities: the Community Corrections Act subsidy, county probation reimbursements, and the Department of Corrections Supervision Services, the three delivery systems. The sentencing guidelines on page 11 has the same lease, purchase, out-of-state travel prohibition rider. And then finally, we have section 9, which statutorily appropriates to the Commissioner of Public Safety the 8% of the driver's license DWI reinstatement fee that under current law is credited to the BCA account in the special revenue fund and biennially appropriated. What this does is it takes a direct appropriation and makes it statutory. And that, Mr. Chairman, is Article 1.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Higgins. I just wanted to go back to a...
it's not a limitation.
If I can get the right page here. On page, top of page 6, the Metropolitan Council debt service. Could you just enlighten me as to what that was for?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, these are the bonds that the Metropolitan Council sold the bonds for the 911 armor, and this is just paying it back.
All right.
Paying the debt service on the bonds.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Fredrickson.
I have a question, a little bit of a concern about the prohibition on the use of the appropriation. One of the things that you are prohibiting them from spending money on is technology purchases or upgrades. And I believe sometimes, I have two concerns, sometimes new technology and upgrades can save money by efficiencies and perhaps more. Fewer people doing more with the new technology, and this would prevent them from adopting that new technology. And my second concern is the repair of existing technology. Oftentimes, the technology that's even what we would consider fairly recently purchased of just a few years old, maybe even a couple years old. You go to have it repaired, and there are no parts for it. They can't be repaired, and they'll have you purchase. It's cheaper to purchase new, and that's also an upgraded system or an upgraded device. And I guess I'm wondering if there should be a clause in here except for when there would be efficiencies that would save money or it's needed to replace existing, but it would also involve an upgrade.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, we had a quick conversation with the Department of Corrections this morning, and we believe we need to tweak this language, and we'll work with the departments to make sure that items like that are taken care of. We don't have any exact language right now, but we know that that's one of the things we need to fix.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. just a
yes, sir, stop.
Over here in the corner.
Yes.
I know it's hard to see. Thank you. On page 9, clause C, I haven't seen this language before for agencies. Sometimes as a chair you'd like to see it, but how do you assume the interaction between, let's say, an agency and the legislative process? Would you have to call in, let's say, somebody from the Department of Corrections if your committee wanted to have information on certain subjects or what was the rationale behind that clause C?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, our departments have been very good about being at our meetings and coming when we ask and giving information. This is in corrections. We have, we've got the commissioner, deputy commissioner, assistant commissioner. They have a legislative liaison as well. And the department has this practice of having one of their 10 wardens come down to the legislature for basically 5 months out of the year to be here to answer questions or whatever. And I think in the, the tight budget that they're going to be having to look at, we wanted to have them consider whether that was a good use of a warden's time with all of the budget problems that we have. You can also see that, where's that other? You could maybe look at that in connection with the paragraph starting at 8.24, where we ask the department to consolidate staff in the institutions that are geographically close to each other. As an example, you've got, is it Oak Park Heights and Stillwater that are about 3 miles apart? Do they each need a warden, especially, when one warden comes down here half the year? Do they need their full complement of deputy wardens and assistant wardens at both places? Do they need the human resources folks, the technology folks in both buildings? Can they get by with one? And these are all shall considers. We want them to look at all of these things that may give them good efficiencies.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And then Article 2 was...
Mr. Backus will do Article 2, Mr. Chair. 2 and 3.
Mr. Chair and members, Articles 2 and 3 then have a new number of policy changes that are, for the most part, related to either budget items or financial matters within the bill. And beginning on page 14, then, of the division report, sections 1 to 5 and 22 of Article 2 repeal current law mandatory minimum sentences for controlled substance offenders for first through fifth degree. Under current law, repeat offenders are subject to mandatory sentences, and they range from 4 years in prison for a first degree offense to 6 months in the county jail for a fifth degree offense. And those are being repealed. Section 6 amends the controlled substance law provision providing for stays of adjudication or deferred sentences for certain low-level drug offenders. And what this provision does is currently it's permissive. A judge can give the sentence for a person if they're eligible. This would make it presumptive, and a court would either have to issue the stay of adjudication or state in writing substantial and compelling reasons for not doing so. Sections 7 to 9 and 11 make conforming changes to the felony DWI law that are necessitated because of Section 10. Section 10 amends the felony DWI law. There's a sentencing provision there that requires a sentencing judge to impose a 3-year mandatory minimum sentence on a felony DWI offender. Now, the judge is not required to execute the sentence, just impose it, but that is being stricken. There's another provision there being stricken which prohibits the Commissioner of Corrections from releasing a felony DWI offender under the Challenge Incarceration Program or any other early release program if the offender has not been through chemical dependency treatment program while in prison. Section 12 repeals the mandatory minimum sentence that applies to violations of the Predatory Offender Registration Law. Sections 13 to 17, 19, and 20 amend the laws addressing how long a person must spend in prison at a minimum. Under current law, a person is required to spend a minimum of 2/3 either in prison or jail. This would change that down to 60%. And these changes apply prospectively for crimes committed on or after July 1. I mention that because originally it was going to be retroactive, but it's no longer so. Section 18 places a 90-day cap on the amount of time the Commissioner of Corrections can incarcerate a supervised release violator following a revocation of supervised release for a first-time supervised release violation. And the cap doesn't apply to sex offenders, though. Supervised release is when a person is released from prison and is in community correctional supervision, so it's post-prison release. Section 21 is connected with Section 10. It requests the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission to consider re-ranking the felony DWI offense at a lower severity level. Article 3, then, Sections 1 and 2 provide that when criminal justice agencies report to the legislature, they do so electronically, and it also addresses how copies of the report are to be submitted to other entities, such as the Legislative Reference Library. Sections 3 to 6 implement the recommendations of the legislative auditor relating to the MinCorps program. MinCorps is our Minnesota's prison industry program. Section 3 requires that the MinCorps marketing plan address attracting businesses from state and local government agencies. Currently, the plan addresses private business, attracting private business. Section 4 requires MinCorps to include its full costs for inmate wages and the money it receives from the department for inmate confinement costs in its annual financial statements, and then requires MinCorps to disclose how the money it receives for inmate confinement costs affects its profitability. Section 5 requests MinCorps to use revenue contracts, not purchase orders, when dealing with private businesses, and requires MinCorps to adopt a uniform method to report sales and expenditure data related to dealings with private business. Section 6 prohibits MinCorps from working on projects until a contract has been signed or from working or from continuing work on a contract after it has expired. Then Sections 7 to 12 and 23 make changes to the conditional release program for nonviolent controlled substance offenders. Currently, the certain drug offense offenders, all of the possession offenses, and then the lower-level sales crimes that are committed because of an addiction, those offenders can apply and receive early conditional release from the Commissioner of Corrections. They must have served at least 36 months or one half of their sentence in prison. They must have completed a chemical dependency program while in prison. They can't have a violent past, and they can't pose a danger to the public. So that's the program that we're addressing here. Section 7 expands it to include second-degree controlled substance sales and nonviolent, non-drug offenses. Section 8 addresses how the Commissioner of Corrections is to make certain determinations related to the program. Section 9 and then 23 strike and repeal language regarding an extension of incarceration provision related to the program. Section 10 requires the Commissioner of Corrections to consult with a panel of judges when making release decisions under the program. And 11 requires the Chief Justice to appoint three retired judges to advise the Commissioner, and then requires the Chief Justice to determine their compensation, and then the Department of Corrections is responsible for those costs. Section 12 requires that the Commissioner use any savings realized from the early release program for chemical dependency treatment programs in state prisons. Section 13 requires the...
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, sir, can you give me any idea of what kind of track record you have with the effectiveness of the chemical dependency programs that are in? You know, we're going to expanded release. How effective are they, and what kind of recidivism rate do we have?
Do you know the numbers? Maybe some...
Senator Higgins.
Senator Olson... probably as Deputy Commissioner Crist should come and give us the real numbers, but I believe that our corrections community or chemical dependency program has a very is rated as a very good program, and that I do have numbers, and that going through the treatment program significantly cuts down on the recidivism rate for those folks who have gone through the CD treatment, and maybe Mr. Crist can give us a real number. What I have isn't giving that number.
Mr. Crist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think the number is that our chemical dependency treatment programs make an individual about 25% less likely to come back to prison after completing one of those programs.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner, what's the length of time that they spend in that, well, in the prison? What's the length of the chemical dependency program?
Mr. Chris.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, our treatment programs are now competency-based. The expectation is that the offender participate in the program until he gets it, rather than just say 90 days and assume that they've been treated adequately and release them from the program. Most offenders will spend anywhere from 6 to 18 months in the program, depending on how quickly they catch on.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, while he's there really quick, how many DWIs do you have to have before you go to a state prison?
Mr. Crist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, I believe it's 5 in a 10-year period.
4
in 10-year period, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Bacchus?
Thank you, and Senator Day, too, with the felony DWI program, it's the 4th and 10. That would make it a felony DWI, but you don't necessarily go to prison. It depends how the judge is going to sentence you. It could be a local sentence. Section 13, then, requires the Commissioner of Corrections to annually report to the legislature specified information on the felony DWI law. Sections 14 and 15 amend the current the Challenge Incarceration Program, which is Minnesota's boot camp program, and they're intended to increase participation in the program. Currently, the Commissioner is authorized to offer spots to offenders who meet the eligibility criteria. This would require the Commissioner to offer spots to all offenders who are eligible, and then would make eligibility and non-eligibility a statutory provision rather than have it discretionary elements with the Commissioner. Section 15 specifies that the Challenge Incarceration Program offenders would be confined either at MCF Moose Lake, Willow River, or MCF Togo. 16 to 19 address licensure for firefighters. Section 16 amends the Board of Firefighter Training and Education to give them the authority and the responsibility to license firefighters. Section 17 defines terms related to the licensure. Section 18 requires the board to appoint an organization to prepare and administer firefighter certification exams, specify how the exams should be designed and who's eligible to take them. Section 19 requires full-time firefighters to be licensed on or after July 1, 2011, and it authorizes but doesn't require volunteer firefighters to seek licensure. There's a grandfather provision included for firefighters employed before July 1, 2011, and a license under the provision is going to be valid for 3 years and cost $75. And the A9 amendment changed this provision a little bit to clarify that the fees are going to be put into a special revenue account and then appropriated to the board for their costs involved with this program. Section 20 amends the current vehicle and traffic surcharge law to provide that when a chief executive officer of a correctional facility collects the surcharge, that the person will then forward it to the court administrator as opposed to the Commissioner of Finance. Section 21 requires the Commissioners of Corrections and Public Safety and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to review its reports for possible consolidation. Section 22 requires the Commissioner of Corrections to report to the legislature on the MinCorp marketing plan. And then 23 contains a series of repealers. Two relate to the conditional release for nonviolent offender program. One is the extending incarceration provision that we talked about. The other repeals the sunset of the program, so that would make the program permanent. The provision also repeals a few reports related to out-of-state juvenile placements. And then finally, repeals a penalty provision applicable to the scrap metal law. Currently, we have two penalty provisions inadvertently, so it repeals one of them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bacchus. Senator Higgins, do you have an idea of the if you kind of took a summation of all the policy changes in the over time, and I assume that would have some kind of a reduction in cost to both state, local, whoever that might apply to, Has that been reflected in the out year budget?
Mr. Chair, we didn't put in the spreadsheet specific line items for the policy provisions, but let's see. Our projections are that they would save 196 beds in 2010, 380 beds in 2011, 489 beds in 12, and 550 in 13. And yeah, that's right. Okay. When we started looking at these, the 60-40, the change from two-thirds, one-third to 60-40, we were going to make it retroactive, and there were big bed savings there, and that is no longer the case. And so that starts basically, you know, July 1st for crimes committed. So we won't see savings until probably the next biennium on those. The budget savings for those four is, you know, $1.6 million the first year, $3.9 the second, $7.4 the third, and $9.8 the fourth.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. When you talk about the that range, is the 1.6 translate into FY 11?
That's or 2010, FY 12. Mr. Chair.
2010. So the savings would actually be accrued in 2010, and then so on, 2011, 2012, and 2013. Okay. So that's a significant savings. Mm-hmm. So. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Higgins, you were talking earlier about the approximately 5+% annual increase that we've been having since 2000. How have you factored in that, if that continuation of offense comes, how does that factored in? Or to what extent do the changes that you're proposing reduce that increase?
Senator Higgins?
Say it again. Do you want to tackle that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman.
Turner?
The Department of Corrections population is forecast. The Department of Finance, with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and the Department, come up with out-year estimates. And so their tails, the tails that are listed in the general fund balance reflect those forecasts. And we, for example, in this year's budget, the correctional tails for institutions, they don't straight line like every other agency. They go up $334 million in fiscal year 12 reflects that percentage increase. Then in 13, it's $339 million. So it's like a lot of the Department of Human Services programs, and that the increase is built in. And that calculation is done by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and the Department of Finance and the Department of Corrections.
So, Mr. Chairman, what I was asking is,
Senator Olson,
if the forecast, I presume, was based on historical, in terms of both the rate of incarceration, then translating it to dollars. But is there a fiscal note essentially that is applied to your? The policy changes in this bill that reduce that incarceration rate, or that
Senator,
is that factored in as to what that overall rate is and what those policy changes might do in order to reflect
Mr. Chair and Senator
Higgins,
according to a chart that we received in our division, in 2009, the department projects that we would have an increase of 206 more people in bed. The policy changes, I believe, would make a change of 106. So,
okay. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Frederickson.
Mr. No. Chairman, Senator Higgins, are you ready for a small amendment?
You have a which that or such?
Mr. Chairman. Senator Higgins, no, just some phrasing I don't like. Okay. It's on page 9. It's the issue, I believe, that Senator Stump raised about the warden monitoring the legislative session.
Uh-huh.
I don't like the way that sounds, and think of somebody taking it out of context. It sounds like we're on work release here or on probation, and I don't want to see it ended up in a comedian's routine, like the Jay Leno show or something like that.
I really don't want to see that either, Senator Frederickson. Do you have some other language for us?
Senator Frederickson.
Senator Higgins, members, on page 9, line 8, I would move to delete having and insert assigning. And also on line 8, delete monitor and insert to serve as a legislative liaison during. So that phrase would be the commissioner shall consider discontinuing the department practice of annually assigning a warden to serve as a legislative liaison during the legislative session.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a
Senator
terrific amendment.
Higgins. Okay, on Senator Frederickson's amendment, any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Senator Higgins, Section 18 in Article 2 about the capping the incarceration after a violation of supervised release. I just wanted to know if that would apply only to technical violations of probation, or does that apply to say you commit a new crime? Would this cap apply as well?
Senator or Mr. Baucus?
Madam, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, it doesn't specify, but my understanding is that if a person is convicted of a new crime, that person is going to be punished for that offense. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you know, the revocation of the supervised release isn't as much of an issue because the person is being punished separately. But there's no specificity that says it only applies to a technical violation.
Could be a new crime.
Just to further clarify, I mean, Mr. Turner mentioned, I mean, for example, if it's a non-felony crime, if it's a misdemeanor crime, it would apply to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, so that's okay, it would just the violation wouldn't this would this cap would apply, and then if they're convicted of a different crime, they could get additional sentence for that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask somebody at the table who can give me an answer on this. Maybe Senator Higgins knows. I'm not an expert on crime and punishment, but I've long thought that one of the goals we should have, and this goes back many years, that we should try to modify human behavior at the lowest cost possible. And I would say that some people can probably be taught to change their ways with just a stern scolding from their mom and dad or the judge or society, and they'll correct their ways, and other people just for psychological reasons, emotional reasons, just can't change, and they just keep doing the same bad things over and over again. So I know you've got a lot of money saved in this bill by reducing penalties and jail time, prison time, and so forth. And I tend to think that's probably a good idea, because I know we've kind of gotten, you know, politically we like to be tough on crime and keep increasing penalties, and it sounds good in speeches and so forth. But from a conservative standpoint, I get back to the idea of let's try to modify behavior at the lowest cost possible. But I'm no expert on crime and punishment. So what I'm wondering about with your bill here and the way you've reduced penalties and so forth, who is supporting that? Do you have support from criminologists and others who are experts on this whole subject, or what do the experts say about what you're doing here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, we discussed a lot of these. Well, I guess probably all of these provisions in the Judiciary Committee, the Policy Committee, and we had folks from the University of Minnesota in the law school, I guess it's called, who came and testified as to, for example, the recidivism, the effect on recidivism of the length of incarceration time, and
the studies that they cited said that anything past about a year is just warehousing. It doesn't really affect the recidivism rate. So if you're there for a year and a half or 5.5 years, there isn't a study that actually shows that that when you are released from prison, you're more likely to not commit a crime again if you've been there for 5 years rather than a year and a half. So it seems to be that the breaker is a year and thereabouts. So that was a piece of what we were looking at when we were discussing the change to that 7% reduction from 67% of time incarcerated to 60. The Council on Crime and Justice came and spoke to us, and they do a lot of studies about crime and justice, incarceration time, drug sentencing, all those kinds of things, and so they were at the table in support. The county attorneys were split. We had one county attorney who raged at us, and another who said, "You're on the right track." So, you know, that is what it is. But
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Dillon,
just a quick follow-up. Okay, if we're going to let them out early, have we done anything to help them get a job or get a house, or is this problem of getting out and everybody, because of the internet, knows everything about everybody else, and it's, at least they can find out that you're a crook and you're a felon and you're just and so on, you're on probation, and if these people can't get jobs and they can't get a house to live in, they're bound to be. There's going to be economic pressure on them to return to a life of crime.
Mr. Chair and Senator Deal, good question. 2 years ago, in the first budget that I had put together as chair of this division, we appropriated a fairly significant amount of money to what we call reentry for helping folks when they come out of prison to do exactly the things that you say, get a job, get health care, get a place to live, be a productive member of society again. We don't have any money this year, but what we did do in the Office of Justice Grants part of this bill is say that one of our three priorities for that new funding that we're getting from the federal government is continued funding for reentry programs. In addition, Senator Moi has a policy bill that's going through that she calls the Minnesota Second Chance Act, dealing with some of the things that we can do to help people to stay out of trouble and become productive members of society when they return from prison. And that, I believe, is on general orders, and we'll be discussing that at some time on the floor. We know that if somebody gets a chance to have a stable job, a stable place to live, good relationships with their family and the community, they are less likely to return to criminal activities. For example, there are a couple of programs that are in my district that are working with offenders, and they're having great success with helping people find jobs. You know, if you've been incarcerated for 6 years or 8 years, having a job, working outside in the sun, using your muscles, you know, being tired at the end of the day when you go home is a good thing. And so I think that Minnesota is in many ways leading the nation on trying to make sure that people get a second chance at being productive and being a good citizen. And if I had money, I'd put more money into that. I don't have any money. But we're doing the best we can with the OJP.
Okay.
That was a speech, and I didn't expect to do that. I'm sorry.
And speaking of offenders, I was kind of the worst offender earlier today, but we still have Senator Betzold's bill we have to do. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just got to mention one thing about one of Senator Betzold's bills. He's got a dog and cat bill that in Senator Betzold's dog and cat bill, if you've ever been convicted of being cruel to animals, you can never get another job working for a puppy mill or a dog and cat farm. And if there's those kinds of things scattered throughout state law where you do something wrong, you can't get a job in certain areas, I think that doesn't help.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, for example, in Human Services, Senator Berglund isn't here, but we have page after page after page of jobs that you can't have if you've been convicted of a crime in our Human Services. And some of them are, you know, a five-year ban from having those jobs. Some are a seven-year. Some are 15-year. Mm-hmm. Some are lifetime. Someplace on my computer I have a list of all the different professions that you can't be if you have a felony on your record. I think it goes like 15 pages. And sometime when we get a group of people who'd like to work on that, I would like to start looking at that list and seeing if there are appropriate ways that we can pare that list down to maybe crimes committed in that field, mm-hmm. you know, that you cannot be there. But if you committed, like, mortgage fraud, is there a reason that you can't be a good healthcare worker? And we've got some of those kind of disconnects. And so I think we have some work left to do that we can help out some people to get a second chance. And that's not in this bill. It's someplace in the future.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dill, it's gotten to a point where in my bill, Senator Latz had a proposal where prospective students would be given a warning because, you know, they don't have to tell that they've had a felony conviction when they sign up for college. I mean, but there are so many professions that they can't get a license for. So we have students who go to a school for 2-4 years, then they go to the licensing board. They find out they've got a felony conviction because they have to tell them then, and they can't get a license. So, yeah, we've become very, very restrictive on people's ability to get jobs after they've been incarcerated.
And, Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, we used to have a goofy thing in state law that said that you couldn't be a barber or work in the field of cosmetology if you had a felony. But we taught barbering and cosmetology in our prisons. So you probably helped fix that 4 or 5 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I'd love to work with you on that. And Senator Dill, this Monday of this week, I had an opportunity to visit the IFI unit, the Albert named for Al Cui, our former governor, at Lino Lakes. And there was about 131 prisoners sitting around us. And it was quite an experience. They have, of the ones who complete that program, which has been going for several years, they have a 3% recidivism rate. So there are things that can be done. They have all of the elements and more. And it's a voluntary program, but we need to focus on this kind of thing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think our boot camp, the CIP, the Challenge Incarceration Program, has a recidivism rate about that same, 3-5%. And we know that that's a program that we should really expand and use to its best capacity. And we try to do that here in this bill.
And Mr. Chair, it's all privately funded except for the board and room and guard for
the IFI.
Yes.
Great.
I don't know if there are other amendments. There was a request for testimony on the bill. Maybe we could just have a couple of minutes. Sir, you would.
Hi.
Yes, welcome to the committee.
My name's Jan Graves. I'm a former employee of Oak Park Heights, and I'm a dental hygienist. I'm very concerned about line 91 on the spreadsheet that is discontinuing preventative dental care and most urgent dental care for the prisons. I've been in touch with Marshall Schreg of the Board of Dentistry. He, in turn, has been in touch with the Board of Medical Practice. It's an outrageous proposal by Nan Larson, the Director of Health Services. I'm doing everything I can as a former employee, but as a concerned dental hygienist who advocates for any dental patient, but exceptionally for the offenders at Oak Park Heights, where I used to work. Under Ms. Larson's proposal, she would be having a roaming dental team visit that facility 1 day a month, and I don't think that's in the fiscal best interest of the state. I think that it's mandatory that the offenders are able to maintain the dental care that they've had. Excuse me, Senator Coyne?
Go ahead.
It's an ironic thing, and it's a bizarre thing, in my opinion, that offenders have a right to medical care, but they honestly do. And according to the Supreme Court, Estelle versus Gamble, back in 1976, dental care is equal to that of medical care. I don't see Ms. Larson proposing medical cuts for the offenders. She's talking about using outside contractors. I speak from personal experience when I tell you how incredibly difficult it is to get a special duty patient out of Oak Park Heights to a private dental clinic. Mm-hmm. It's virtually impossible. The other thing, I guess, that I wanted to mention is that I was at Oak Park Heights when all the construction was going on and the double bunking was taking place. And I can't tell you how many millions of dollars was spent bunking the transitional care unit, which is our hospital, and it was never used. We spent millions of dollars double bunking a portion of our transitional care unit, and it was never used. Talk about a waste. The line item 91 is suggesting a $1.2 million cut. Please don't support this. There are other ways to save money in corrections. The litigation, the unprecedented litigation that will ensue when these offenders don't have timely dental care. Did you folks know that Oak Park Heights has a hospice? Did you know that they have a hospital? Did you know they have a dialysis unit? With all of the research that's been substantiated recently with the association between dental disease and overall health, why on earth would you plug a man into a dialysis unit when you're denying him timely care for an active dental infection? Under Nan Larson's proposal, an LPN is going to make that decision. Or perhaps Nan Larson, who has a 4-year degree in Russian literature, who is hardly qualified to determine whether or not those dental patients are sent to the outside or not. Thank you for listening to my testimony. I can't tell you how passionate I am. If it's not maintained, you're going to have big problems with the Board of Dentistry and the Board of Medical Practice, and I won't stop as a personal citizen and advocate until it's back in. So try to avoid this problem and maintain that $1.2 million in the budget.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Grace, for your testimony, and you underscore, obviously, some of the negative things that are being proposed and are going to be done this year relative to the budgets, and your testimony does suggest that there are a lot of things being proposed and things arguably that are going to be done that will have some very significant repercussions in the future, leading to greater expense than kind of this course we're embarked on, but that's one of the discussions we'll have as we get into the conference committee process with the governor, as to some of your testimony.
Excuse me, sir, one more thing. Remembering that we are no longer nationally accredited, that's unconscionable in my opinion. There was earlier testimony using statistics from Louisiana. They have ACA accreditation. We don't have any prison accreditation. We let it lapse. So if we still had accreditation in this state, the dental department would not be cut like this.
No question that a lot of what we'll do this year, to use the cliche, will be penny wise, pound foolish, no question.
Yes, thank you. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you. So I appreciate Ms. Graves offering her testimony. Is there further amendments to Senator Higgins' bill?
Seeing none, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate File 802 as amended be recommended to pass and go to the floor.
Okay, we have the Higgins motion in front of us. All those in favor, signify by Senator Day.
I just have a quick comment. This is the second bill. Senator Stump had the first horse out that we killed, and Senator Higgins.
Actually number four.
This is Senator Higgins. The governor said safety was a high priority. And said that fire, police, ambulance, and our correction system and is highly important to the Minnesotans. So his budget didn't have the cuts. I totally agree with the lady that talked about the dental, because in Faribault I have talked to the people there, and she's right on that one. That one's something I totally agree with. So it seems like what we're doing, and we have, you know, 48th in incarceration, so we already, so we're going to just throw it open and say, you know, we won't incarcerate hardly anybody. We're going to go 50 and go the other way, because what you have in the bill, to me, is a bill that, to balance what you want to do, is actually, I personally believe it's a bill that is totally soft on crime. We already are already down per capita incarceration. We'll be last. And we want to go further down. And we're doing that because we're talking about a lack of money, and yet the governor's budget has said that this was a high priority, along with education and whatever. So I'm having a hard time who's convincing you or who's convinced Senator Stump to take things that are high priorities to Minnesotans and say, oh, we're going to cut them all the same. And I guess maybe there are no priorities in how you feel or Senator Stump feel, and that the right way is to cut everybody equal. I guess if that's it, that's what we're going to do. But it would seem that people that are ahead of a division or a chairman of a area in the state, that this is their thing, that if the governor said, hey, no cuts, I don't know. I know if I was a chairman, I would go to the wall with the no cuts and hang tough with the governor if that's what I really firmly believed in. So what worries me is then when the cuts come, what does this do? Does this? I just don't want a whole. You might want people running around your neighborhood. I don't want people running around my neighborhood. And I totally agree. I was on the board of the federal prison in Waseca. I worked with the school superintendent who quit as a superintendent in Owatonna and teamed up with the Chamber of Commerce head in Owatonna, and I worked with them to put together a company to help people when they come out of prison. And I totally agree that we do a terrible job with getting people jobs when they get out of prison. But I just I'm going to throw it out. Your bill is, as I mentioned, too soft for me, I guess.
Well, Senator Day, I don't think it's fair to direct those comments to Senator Higgins. They're better directed to myself. And I can tell you Senator Higgins has been I guess the phrase would be tireless advocate.
Whiner is another word.
A tireless whiner relative to her budget and some of the problems. But, you know, you talk about it's a decision that doesn't take place in this committee, but you talk about what we're doing in terms of public safety. I think there's an argument to be made, and I've heard it from mayors throughout the state of Minnesota, and I'll just point out, not just simply the mayor of my city, but mayors throughout the state, that the governor's proposed cuts to the LGA program have a direct impact on public safety in the cities throughout the state, and not just the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. And, you know, we're seeing potential police reductions and fire reductions in these cities as a direct consequence of what the governor proposes relative to LGA. So, in putting a budget together.
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to know that you're the priority person and not Senator Higgins. So maybe you're absolutely right. So what you're saying is that you think everything is always on an equal 7% and there are no priorities either. Education is not a priority. Safety isn't a priority. You're saying everything is equal.
No, keep in mind, what I wanted to say was that we are forced, if we look at the governor's LGA proposal, to try to take that into account in setting budget targets for the divisions, because we obviously don't propose, when you see Senator Bach's bill, it will not propose anywhere near the cut in LGA payments that the governor proposes. And that's every bit as much an impact on public safety, and I would argue much more so an impact on public safety, because I don't diminish Senator Higgins' budget at all, but we have prisoners who are incarcerated. They will be incarcerated. Whether or not we will have police on the street to stop the crime, to respond to the crime, is a different issue, because under the governor's budget, we won't, with what he does with LGA. But certainly, and if I can just finish, Senator Day, you've brought Senator Stumpf into the discussion. It should be pointed out that the cut to public education as a consequence of the stimulus money was significantly less than, you know, kind of an across-the-board type of approach. So we've tried to take an approach that's looked at some of these needs throughout the state, and certainly as a consequence, and keep in mind, with Senator Higgins, there was some significant federal stimulus money put into her bill to negate what might have been a proposed cut.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I appreciate your comment. I just want to make one other comment, because along the same line, Senator Day, you talked about your opposition to cutting dental care for prisoners, and while I agree with you, I don't want to do that either, but I think it's important to realize that, again, when it comes to priorities, the governor's budget doesn't cut corrections, but it cuts health care programs that mean dental care for people who have not committed crimes would be cut under the governor's budget. That's his alternative, is to cut dental care for low-income Minnesotans, for senior citizens in Minnesota who have not committed crimes. And that is the governor's plan as an alternative. So you can't just isolate one cut and say you prefer not to cut this, because if you don't cut this, then you're going to make those other choices that Senator Cohen has talked about that impair public safety, prevention programs, and health care for people who have not committed crimes.
Mr. Chairman, to answer the question, I'm interested in prioritizing. And I served 12 years on local government, city and county. And when a county tells me or a city tells me they can't cut 5%, I look at them and I roll my eyes. Cut out some of the trains then, or trails, or goodness, a whole bunch. They're always going to, well, we're going to cut the police and the fire.
Senator Day,
I mean, local governments, because I don't buy into it. And first off, and last, but I look at my tax statement and, the state isn't represented on my local tax statement in Owatonna. It's just schools and counties and cities. So they can do whatever they want, but that whole bit about, oh, we're going to – plus the governor put $8 million into counties to house prisoners a little bit longer, if I believe that was in his budget. But I'm not arguing the governor's thing. I'm just saying, don't anybody believe there's any priorities? That's all I'm asking, and I guess you don't. I think we have to do something by priorities. Guess not.
Okay. Well, I want to be
– Chairman.
That's 42 to 20, so I think I'm on the wrong side of this issue a little bit. I mean, when we vote, this will be the answer. So
actually 46 to 21.
But there you go. But I figure, at least we'll talk about it a little bit, because I hope my city and my county doesn't come up here talking about local government aid. If they come and talk to me about local government aid, I will get to tell you, they will not spend a long time in my office, because I served, and I can tell you, I can cut 5% of every budget of every city. In fact, the Coalition of Minnesota Cities, which the Mayor of Wadena arrives and gives this talk, and I belong to the Coalition of Cities, and he can't cut 94,000, and he's got a surplus of 1.2 million. And he says, well, we're saving that for a rainy day. Mayor, it's raining.
And Senator Day, I don't want to get too far afield, so we don't come back here tonight, which is
there you go.
A very distinct possibility.
Mr. Chairman.
But I happen to – I've had concerns about local budgets as well, but I do think this year, as I spent time taking a closer look at local budgets, I do think there is a very strong argument to be made relative to police fires. Senator Pariseau?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to echo some of what
Senator Day has been talking about by cutting dental service, I think they're taking a big risk. Frankly, I had people who were high up in the State Association of Dentists who were taking one day out of their practice every week and going down to the Faribault School to make sure that all the people who were there were having dental service, and they did it free. And they didn't get return for on it. And besides, they were probably crossing their boards, scope of practice model that they tried to keep in the association, and they had to fight the board. And finally, it took years and years and years of complaints from many dentists saying, we can always volunteer someplace once a week or once every month. Let us do it. But they wouldn't let them do it for a long time when they finally allowed that to happen. And I think this is one of the places you can use a good program like that. And so I think rather than cutting out the dental services, you can take a veil of what people are offering already.
Further comments, questions? Senator Higgins renews her motion Senate File 802 be as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you,
Senator
much.
Higgins. Let's start Senator Betzold's bill. My best guess is we're not going to finish it. We'll have to figure out scheduling at this point, but at least let's get started. Although, who knows, if Senator Betzold, after beating up on Senator Higgins if in her bill, maybe Senator Betzold, you'll go quickly.
It's exciting.
Mr. Chair, can we just move the bill to a vote right now?
We have an amendment.
Oh, okay.
All right with me.
I tried.
All right, Senator Betzold, Senate File,
2082, Mr. Chair. Senator Betzold. Mr. Chair, this is a state government budget bill. For those who may not be familiar, the State Government Budget Division has oversight of the constitutional officers, the legislative budget, which includes the House, the Senate, the LCC areas, some small boards, the major agencies, Department of Revenue, Department of Finance, Department of Administration. And so what a lot of we do cuts across a lot of the state government activities. The budget overall is about a $630 million biennial budget. Given the budget reductions of 7% in this biennium and projected out the next biennium, that translated to about a $44 million cut in each biennium. And so I'll kind of go through some of the major issues in the spreadsheet here with Mr. Lundeen and then go through the bill with Mr. Bodern. I should also note that part of the bill and part of the spreadsheet do reflect a bill from the Secretary of State's office in transferring from paper transactions to electronic transactions, which meant fee adjustments in there. And a lot of the bill, frankly, deals with that. I'll be going through it, but it's also a separate bill, Senate File 1224. Let me just turn it over to Mr. Lundeen to start going through the two-page spreadsheet. I have some comments to make through as we go on, and so I'll just turn it over to Mr. Lundeen to start the budget process here.
Mr. Lundeen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be talking off the change item summary spreadsheet. I think you'll probably have two different documents, a more detailed one, but I'll just highlight on the change items. Taking a look at direct general fund appropriations to the legislature, the Senate, House, and LCC were given the 5% reduction that the governor had recommended in his budget. The governor had also recommended an in lieu of rent offset coming out of the legislative budgets. That was not included in this bill. And the funding for Senator Pogemiller's redistricting commission bill, Senate File 182, the funding is provided here. The language has been traveling as a separate bill. Moving down to this.
Mr. Chair, let me comment. The Senate, although we're taking the same 5% cut that everybody else has taken, we also took a 3% cut last year. We've also, when the allotments came in December, we participated in that too. So the Senate budget has actually gone more than 8% of a cut. And when you consider that most of the Senate's budget is personnel, over 80% of it, that is going to have a significant impact on Senate operations. Go ahead.
Okay. The next item is dealing with the Secretary of State's budget. The operating budget reduction that the governor recommended was also included in the Senate bill. We did make one change that was included in Senate File 1224. This was basically taking some fees that the Secretary of State was getting as a dedicated receipt and merely making that a non-dedicated receipt and then just bumping up their appropriation by the amount of receipts. So that was kind of a wash to the general fund. And another thing we did to the Secretary of State's budget is just to kind of redistribute the base, just to make it equal in both years. There's been a number of kind of tracking issues and stuff because there's various base adjustments that go on in various years depending on the elections, and the Secretary of State does have the ability to move money from one biennium or from one fiscal year to the other within the biennium, so it doesn't really impact their budget. The next is the state auditor. We took the operating budget reduction that the governor recommended of $72,000 a year. And then moving on to the attorney general.
And let me, Mr. Chair, on the state auditor, she was here. I think she had to leave. But we will have an amendment coming forward because the auditor's office does need to track the federal stimulus money. We did have something in your deficiency bill that did it for the current biennium, but we need to take a longer look in that, and we'll have an amendment dealing with that when we get to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, she is still here.
Oh, she's still here. But she had to leave. She's got to leave momentarily, but I did want to make sure while she's still here that she's aware that we are going to be addressing that.
Okay, the next item is the Attorney General's budget, and we took the 5% cut that the governor recommended. Moving down to the governor's office, we took the 5% cut to his general fund appropriation that he had recommended. The in lieu of rent allocation, we didn't take that redistribution. The next is moving down to the Department of Administration. Tying in with that in lieu of rent offsets that were going on in the legislature and the governor's office, and I believe also in the Minnesota Historical Society, but that's not included within this budget area. This was basically the governor was requesting $500,000 a year, and in lieu of rent covers the state office building, the Capitol, the governor's residence, and the services for blind and the vets organizations that are over in the veterans building. And so they were requesting $1 million increase. We just kept the base level funding of about almost $7.9 million a year.
And Mr. Chair, beyond the 5% cut to the form of administration, we had to go deeper, and one of the programs that we have proposed to eliminate is the Enterprise Performance Improvement, the LEAN program. That actually was written up favorably in a Star Tribune editorial. It's a small office. It does a lot of work to help government become efficient, but in order to meet the targets, we had a proposed elimination of it.
Okay, and also continuing with the Department of Administration, I mean, there were a number of other funding requests that we did not do. We did not do the transfer of the EQB to the PCA. We did eliminate the self-advocacy network grant. That has been totally eliminated in this budget. And then we also did take the operating budget reduction that the governor had recommended in his budget. Moving down next is the Department of Finance, and we took the operating budget reduction that the governor recommended there of nearly $2 million for the biennium. We made another cut to the Management Analysis and Development Division. This was a program that was previously in the Department of Administration, and the governor moved it into the Department of Finance, and I believe there is a bill that we did here in the division a couple days ago, Senator Gimsey's bill, that does move this entire program and the revolving fund portion of it. So we have done nothing dealing with the revolving fund. It's just the general fund appropriation. Then the other requests that were made, the stimulus funds reporting and oversight, no money is included in this bill. We did include some funding in Senator Cohen's Senate File 1938 of about $700,000 for that purpose. There's no money for the federal stimulus match contingency. and there's no funding for the financial oversight and assistance request of $700,000 a year, although in Senator Cohen's Senate File 2, we did include $512,000 a year to cover the six FTEs dealing with the internal controls that was requested by the governor. Moving down to the Office of Enterprise Technology, we did not do the data center consolidation.
Mr. Chair, let me comment on that. The governor has proposed the purchase-to-own option on some of these issues, where we would pay instead of just pay for everything at once, pay for it over about a 10-year period. We frankly do need to do something about our computer networks. We have aging systems. They're in closets around the Capitol building areas. And at some point, we do need to consolidate them and upgrade the servers. As I say, this would have been just a continuing payment of $16 million. But as I say, it's a governor's proposal, but we didn't even have the money to purchase to own, let alone pay for the whole thing.
Okay, and the next item where we made a cut was in the IT security general fund appropriation. We cut the base appropriation in half in the first year of the biennium and then eliminated it in the second year and going out. And there's some language in the bill that does direct the chief information officer and the commissioner of finance to develop a plan for charging back to agencies and so forth. So this would actually be something that would be charged back to the agencies, and they would then have to forward the funds based on the rate package that's developed.
And Mr. Chair, this comes on the heels of a report by the legislative auditor saying that computer security, especially for small agencies, is woefully inadequate. So, you know, this goes in the opposite direction of where we need to go, but as I say, this is one of the cuts.
And then the last item with the Office of Enterprise Technology is the operating budget reduction that the governor recommended was included in the Senate bill. Moving down next to the Campaign Finance Board, the operating budget reduction that the governor recommended, we took that into account, and at the same time we did provide a increase to the operating budget based on a bill that Senator Betzel had and testimony from the Campaign Finance Board. So that was an additional $50,000 a year. We also did make some changes to the campaign public subsidy program. Currently, that's a statutory program, and we've eliminated the statutory appropriation and instead made a direct appropriation for the 10 and 11 biennium. And then in the tails, in order to meet our tails target, we had to eliminate this particular appropriation. We did not touch the checkoff portion of this appropriation, which is forecasted to be about $2.6 million in the 10 and 11 and in the tails biennium.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify, as Mr. Lindeen said, this is the appropriation, $1.2 million that we do, that every candidate who gets public financing gets the same amount of money. Now, then there's differences in what candidates receive because the checkoff money varies by district, and so some candidates get more than other candidates. However, this gets rid of the base number that every candidate would receive. It doesn't affect the checkoff money. That's in the tax committee's jurisdiction. It does not affect the rebate, the $50 rebate that people have for contributing political campaigns. However, this does mean that some of the public subsidy will be reduced because that base amount that we guarantee for every candidate is carried in the next biennium, not this biennium, but the next one.
And then turning over to page 2, at the top is administrative hearings. We did take the budget reduction that the governor had recommended of $15,000 a year. And then we also did make a change. Currently, the administrative hearings gets a transfer of $65,000 a year to deal with campaign complaints, and that comes out of the campaign subsidy appropriation that we were talking about. And just to kind of make things a little more clear and a little easier tracking-wise, we're appropriating that $65,000 directly to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And then moving down the rest of the agencies, the Department of Revenue, we took the operating budget reduction that the governor recommended. This operating budget reduction was a little different than a lot of the other 5% because this was only taken on the non-compliance side, which makes up about a third of the agency. And then the CAP board was given. We took the 5% reduction the governor recommended, the same with the Indian Affairs Council, the Black Minnesotans Council, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the Asian Pacific Council. The Amateur Sports Commission, we did give them an increase. Their base had been cut in the past because we thought that their sports mall complex was going to be coming online out there, and that isn't, and they were going to get some operating funds there. So this is just to kind of, you know, tie them through. And then moving down, there were a few statutory general fund appropriations. I think we did talk about the campaign financing subsidy, and so that's just reflecting that is going to be a direct appropriation from being a statutory appropriation. And then also with the Amateur Sports Commission, we are eliminating the Target Center appropriation, which was scheduled to end in 2009, although there was no sunset date in statute, but in the use agreement, it was to run through 2009. And then we did not do the MAPS replacement lease purchase recommendation that the governor had, nor did we do the completion of the integrated tax system that the governor had recommended. And then moving down, we did do a few transfers and things coming in. First were two Secretary of State-related items from Senator Betzold, Senate File 1224. One was dealing with the international student fee, which I talked about when we were up on the Secretary of State's budget. And the rest were some business filing fees. This is just kind of the net amount. There's some increases and decreases going on, and it for the biennium, it just nets out to be $133,000 to the general fund. These are non-dedicated receipts. The next item is in the Department of Administration. We did two things with the facility repair and replacement account. This is the department's asset preservation account where a portion of the funds that agencies pay in rent are deposited in this account. And so we did take a one-time transfer out of the account of just slightly more than $2 million. There's around a $7 million balance in the account right now. And then what we also did, and this was partially to help us balance our tails in that, is kind of ongoing in the 10 and 11 and in the 12 and 13 biennium, all of the dollars in that account will be going into the general fund. Current statute has 50% going into the general fund, so the $8 million represents the remainder of those funds all going into the general fund.
And, Mr. Chair, this is significant. Just in February, for instance, in the ladies' restroom that's by room 107, the pipe burst. We had a lot of damage in there. This is the fund that helps repair things like in the Capitol and the Capitol complex for repairs of our facilities. And as I say, to balance the budget, we had to find every dollar we could, and the repairs and betterment funds are needed. But as I say, we had to eliminate them here.
Okay, and then the last transfer we had was from the state auditor's budget. This was in the tax increment account. We took a one-time transfer out of there. There had been a balance of a bit more than $2 million that had accumulated there, so we're taking $1 million out of that and transferring to the general fund. And then down below, you just kind of have the general fund reconciliation. The total amount represented in this bill of the direct and open appropriations once we've taken off the revenue gains to the general fund is $579,257,000. So, and that compares to be a little more than $67 million difference less than what the governor had recommended for general fund spending. If you turn to the last page, there are a few non-general fund items. We didn't make any change to the direct appropriations from non-general funds. They're all at base level. There were a couple other things. The Secretary of State, this was included in Senator Betzold's Senate File 1224. The temporary technology surcharge that we had in place for the 8 and 9 biennium has been extended just for the 10 and 11 biennium. And this is some upgrades and enhancements that they are making to a lot of the business filings and stuff that Senator Betzold had referenced earlier. The next item, the Department of Administration, the governor had a language and a proposal in his bill about the cooperative purchasing expansion for local governments. We have not included that in our bill. The next items are just dealing with the lease purchase with for the Department of Finance for maps and for the integrated tax system in the revenue department. Those we did not do. Then there's a license fee ratification for the Racing Commission, and this is a revenue gain of just $4,000. I think it was standardizing some of the existing occupational license fees. And then these receipts are just deposited in the dedicated account for the Racing Commission, and that's where we make the appropriation for the Racing Commission's operations. Then the Office of Technology has a proposal for the electronic licensing fee surcharge. In the 8 and 9 biennium, we provided $7.5 million in general fund to start this project and have a few agencies as a pilot project on it. And so the governor had a proposal to put a surcharge on to continue this appropriation to bring in about $11.7 million for the biennium, and this continues for 6 years to fund this project.
And, Mr. Chair, let me comment on that, because this is something that maybe members have heard from their constituents on. We want to be able to get to a system where we can have people get their professional licenses and renew their licenses online. The problem is that some agencies and boards already have systems to do exactly that, and there are people, realtors, insurance agents, cosmetologists, we have psychologists, social workers that have their own systems, and they don't want to pay for two different systems. They don't want to pay for this system as well as the one they're paying for. We spent quite a bit of time in the budget division trying to resolve this issue. I will have an amendment that I think is going to be able to take care of most concerns, but you've probably have heard from some people about this proposal.
Okay, and then the next item under the Office of Enterprise Technology, this is just referencing the rate package and the fees that, you know, may be charged back to the agencies to recover the general fund cut that we did make for IT security. And then the last, the governor had a recommendation dealing with the Gambling Control Board, and this is actually in the Senate, contained in a bill of Senator Lori's that we have actually not heard yet in the division. And that pretty much wraps up the change items that are included in this bill.
This is everything.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Lundeen? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I had to step out for a few minutes, but I don't think you took the governor's recommendation to transfer EQB from admin to PCA, correct? Because we did not either in my budget.
Mr. Chair, I introduced the governor's proposed budget bill, and because of that provision, it was sent to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. That's where the bill is.
Okay.
And so I just let it sit over there.
Okay. Senator Betzold.
Well, Mr. Chair, we do have the Senate File 2082. Perhaps Mr. Bonner can help us go through the Article 1. I'll have to go through a lot of Article 2 because that's the Secretary of State's provisions, but maybe I'll defer to Mr. Bonner to kind of walk us through the first couple of sections of Article 1.
Mr. Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, most of Article 1 has already been discussed in some detail in the walkthrough in the spreadsheet, and the remaining language that wasn't discussed is typically it's language that's been carried from biennium to biennium. If there are, I can highlight a few things for you that might be worthy of note. On page 3, on line 7, you'll see the appropriation for the expenses of the redistricting commission, and that specifically states that's only if Senate File 182 is enacted. At the bottom of page 3, there is language that's carried from biennium to biennium that requires the Commissioner of Finance to report to the legislature concerning personnel costs incurred by the governor's office, supported by appropriations to other agencies. On page 4 for the Secretary of State, on line 15, this essentially it repeats what has already been done, but just for the sake of security, it appropriates funds in the Help America Vote Act for purposes that have been authorized under Section 5.30. Section 8, you'll see the direct appropriation in the second year for the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board to the State Elections Campaign Fund. There are a number of items on page 5, beginning on page 5, line 10, that remove requirements imposed in the 2007 budget bill to determine savings attributable to certain measures. This one here on line page 5, line 10, is for the savings attributable from the electronic licensing system. Then on page 5, under the Office of Administrative Hearings, you'll see the direct appropriation for the performance of duties for that office with respect to unfair campaign practices hearings. Skipping ahead on page 7, there's another item similar to the one I mentioned earlier under the Department of Revenue on line 26. Again, this calls out a provision in the previous biennial budget bill and renders that inoperative. That's the duty to determine savings attributable to the integrated tax software package. And that really completes anything that would appear different or would require further explanation in Article 1.
Okay, Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Article 2, basically the first seven sections are part of the Senate File 1224, which is the Secretary of State's bill. Some of it's just plain housekeeping, but in order to do the housekeeping things and transferring from the paper transactions to electronic, they had to adjust their fees because some of them just don't work in the electronic transfer. The bill was heard in the Judiciary Committee as well as the Budget Division here. I can go through it, but as I say, I'm not quite sure that the full committee really needs to spend their time on Article 2, Sections 1 through 7. Starting on page 15, Section 8 gets back into the areas of the Budget Division, and as I say, the language here just kind of takes care of some of the things that we have already talked about. Section 8 is a campaign finance appropriation elimination. Section 9 is a Budget Division amendment dealing with union dues deduction. That was offered as a Budget Division amendment. Section 10 deals with the facilities repairs that we've already talked about. Section 11 is the e-licensing provision that I mentioned. And if you look on page 18, lines 18.15 to 18, that's some language that we talked about to try to carve out some current groups that already pay for it, but we will have an amendment that I think better reflects what our intention is here. Section 12 is some standard language we've carried in past Budget Division bills on voluntary unpaid leave of absences by government employees. Section 13 is the e-licensing fee provision as well. And then when you pick up on Section 14 on page 20, that starts to get back again to the Secretary of State's housekeeping areas where in their business records area. And that carries through actually to page, right towards the end, to page 35. When we pick up on page 35, Section 31 is the racing licensing fee ratification, as they say, and trading services on Section 32 on page 35 basically was a Budget Division amendment saying that the agencies had to use services by the government training services before contracting with outside. The repealer deals with the appropriation for the Amateur Sports Commission, which, again, deals with the sports mall that didn't happen, and so that's why we're repealing. That's the Target Center. That's the Target Center's repealer. So, Mr. Chair, members, that is a run-through of the bill and the spreadsheets. I do have a couple of amendments. We've got a few more minutes, Mr. Chair, before we start the floor session, but I can at least get some amendments out to you if that's the will of the committee.
Sure. Why don't we give it a try? What amendment would you like to offer, Mr. Chair?
Well, if we could start with the A2 amendment. This deals with the state auditor's ability to monitor the federal stimulus money. And what this would do is basically the auditor collects fees when they conduct audits. This is a one-time increase in the appropriation, but the auditor is going to charge fees to do these audits to ensure compliance with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. So I don't believe we're increasing any, you know, any of the budget targets at all by doing so.
Okay, are we having that distributed?
The A2 amendment.
Mr. Watson, do we not?
I don't find it.
Okay, could we go into another amendment?
So wait, what amendments? Okay, Mr. Bodden has an oral amendment.
Mr. Chairman, it's a very minor one-word change on page 3, line 7, to reflect the way this appropriation is carried on the spreadsheet. Delete first and insert second.
Okay, I'll move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have Senator Betzel's amendment in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Could you repeat that for the clerk, please?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, on page 3, line 7, delete first and insert second.
Okay, you got that. Okay, Senator Betzel?
Yeah, I'll move that.
Well, we've done that.
We've done that. I don't know what amendments we've got, Mr. Chair. I've got the A4 amendment dealing with e-licensing. Is that one available? Okay.
Okay.
Okay, while that's being distributed, as I say, we had a number of groups that don't want to pay for two different e-licensing systems. We had some discussions over the last 2 days to address this area. Basically, this would allow the transfer. Some of these systems already are building up some additional funds, some surpluses. So this would transfer whatever funds and e-licensing systems into this project. It does say that that where the state chief information officer is to give priority to licenses that are not already online. I think that basically takes care of most of the concerns that were raised for us. I don't know if there's – I'm sure there's still people that have some concerns, but I think this deals with most of the issues that came before the Budget Division, the A4 amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berlin.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, are you taking any monies that are in the special revenue account in the Department of Health or Human Services with your bill or with this amendment?
Mr. Lundeen.
No, I believe the only place, and I'll ask Mr. Bodden to correct me if I'm wrong since he's been working on the amendment, but I think the only place in the existing bill that we're taking any monies out of a special revenue fund is in the Department of Commerce for the e-licensing system that they developed and had the authority to collect a fee from the realtors and the insurance agents. The rest of it is just a surcharge on top of existing license fees that will then be deposited in this account.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Senator Betzel's A4 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I believe the A2 amendment is being distributed now, and that deals with the state auditor, as I say, to provide for some compliance with the federal stimulus money.
Okay, we have the A2 amendment in front of us. Again, paid for through the this is a one-time appropriation again.
Yes.
And I think, and Senator Bessel, you indicated with the second deficiency bill, we had dealt with part of this.
Yes.
Any further discussion on the A2 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And then, Mr. Chair, do we have the A7 amendment available? Okay. The A7 amendment, as I indicated, and this is language that's actually tracking also in the tax bill, as I understand it, but a few years ago we required the state auditor to do some reporting on tax increment financing. Since we're moving some of the money that into the general fund, this is better language to correct it. I guess maybe I'd have to defer to Mr. Bodden any further explanation of it. But
Ms. Bodden.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Zuff actually prepared most of this amendment. As it's been explained to me, it reduces reporting requirements for local units of government and thus reduces the auditing requirements for the state auditor.
And I'm told this is in the tax bill as well, too, but since it ties into the state auditor's responsibilities in doing it, that's why I guess there's a desire to have it in this bill as well. And we're transferring the funds as well.
Okay, Senator Betzel moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I've got one more amendment, and it's the A8 amendment. I've got a handout here, and this deals with interagency transfers. There's actually going to be two.
On that
two handouts on this one. We had a discussion in the budget division, and I wanted to deal with it the full finance committee rather than in the budget division, because this crosses through other jurisdictions. Kathleen? The governor's office, we have interagency agreements that cross through all government agencies, and because we want the ability for some people to cross-transfer in other agencies when it's appropriate to do that. The governor's office has been using this and to fund about seven different positions, and, of course, what it amounts to is that there are some positions that are being bits and pieces of funding are taken out of various agencies to fund certain positions. One of the questions I raised is that if the governor believes that he needs these seven people in his office, why don't we just do it cleanly instead of taking little bits and pieces out of the agency's budget? Why don't we just transfer the money from those agencies into the governor's office? That is basically what this bill does. I'm having passed out a sheet that shows what those people are that are holding those positions, where the money is coming from. You've also got a sheet here that indicates where the funding is going over the next couple of bienniums. This does not in any way cut any positions. I think it's just a more transparent way. As I say, when we had the discussions in the budget division, Matt Kramer, the governor's chief of staff, testified. He indicated that what they're doing is proper under state law, and it is. And he said, if you want to change it, go ahead and change it. And this, as I say, I think is a better way to explain to the public who these people are and just transfer the money to the governor and let him hire the people if that's what he wants to do.
And Senator Betzold, a couple things. In looking at the way the amendment's drafted, we don't have to rework other division budgets. We can simply deal with it here. And second, to emphasize again, you're not reducing the governor's staff at all with this amendment.
Not at all. It just transfers the money that is currently being transferred interagency agreements from the agencies into the governor's office. This just moves the money into the governor's office so he can pay for the people out of his own budget.
Okay. We have Senator Anderson.
On that point, I think you said earlier there was a 5% cut overall to the governor's budget with these staff? Did I get that wrong?
Yeah.
Were these staff governor's part of that cut?
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure myself. I mean, the governor has about 40 people working in his office. The books show that it goes down to about 38 people, which would be a 5% cut. But how this plays into that, I don't know. And I don't, Mr. Lundin and Mr. Budden, do you have any idea?
Mr. Lundin?
I don't know.
I can talk to the one spreadsheet that was passed out, the one that says Office of the Governor. And I have taken some of the information that we've gotten both from the Commissioner of Finance and reports that are required, and then also information on staffing and the transfers from the governor's office. And I've kind of based it on the 2009, you know, what were the expenditures there, the amount of transfers, and what was anticipated. And you can see there in 2009, there's the groundskeeper, there's the faith and community coordinator, and then there's the legislative and cabinet affairs. That's a lot of the senior policy advisors. And then also the Federal Affairs Office in Washington, D.C. And these are all positions and things that there are interagency agreements. So it came up with a total of $724,000. And so I've just kind of carried that forward into 10 and 11 as the best estimate of what those costs are going to be. And so that's what the amendment is reflecting. It's taking the governor's appropriation after the 5% cut that's included in the bill, and then just adding the $724,000, bringing the appropriation up to the $4.2 million number.
Well, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point is these are a lot of highly paid staff, and I'm not sure why we would exempt them from the 5% cut. It seems like because we're moving them, they're not cut in either place, either in the home, the governor's office, or in any of the different agencies.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I think that as the bill goes forward and into conference, if the governor feels that by adding the staff to his budget that he wants to apply that to, I think we'll just have to have those discussions. This is kind of new that because we, as I say, I couldn't really deal with it in my division because this crosses other budgets as well, too. So this is the first time we've really had a chance to vet the issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, can you identify off of this list any of these people that would be working in the governor's office that would be in charge of Health and Human Services?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, at the budget division, I did ask Mr. Kramer to go through and tell us what each one of these individuals do. I don't have my notes here right now. Perhaps Mr. Lindeen can help us in identifying who they are and what they do.
I'm here.
Taking a look at the list that was handed out, I don't think on there is showing anything for Health and Human Services. But one of the other reports that we had gotten, which was the rider that I think Mr. Bodern had referenced under the governor's, which we have in every year, requiring the Commissioner of Finance to report to the chairs of the budget divisions in the House and the Senate. I think the Department of Human Services was providing some funding for the faith and community services position. And they also were providing some funding for some of the senior policy advisors. I think there was $25,000 provided in fiscal year 08 for that position. And then also the Department of Health and Human Services was providing in fiscal year 08 about $131,000 towards the D.C. office.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
As this moves forward, you might want to do a little more work on it, Senator Betzel, because I believe the position that was formerly held by Carolyn Jones has been filled by someone else. I'm not sure who it is, but in the governor's office is fully funded out of the Department of Human Services.
Well, again, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, that's my intention. And if there are people that are working in the governor's office or being funded by other agencies, I'd like to identify what there are and just make sure that those show up in one
right.
place, not the way they are right now.
Right. So I think that you might need to look into that and maybe add that to this.
We can try to clean it up, but... Okay, we have Senator Betzel's A8 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any other amendments.
Okay. Senator Foley?
I would offer the A5 amendment.
Okay. If we can have that distributed, then I
think this part of the Mr. Watson is passing it.
And apparently this...
That's what Adam does and OET does. So.
Senator Foley, apparently this is the language that was in Senator Higgins' bill.
Yes.
And so you're making it across the board for the agencies?
It's an effort to promote uniformity in the agencies.
Just the agencies in this bill.
I don't know what I covered.
But Mr. Chair, although this language might fit in some other bills, at least the first part of it, I think we need to monitor, who's buying computers and cell phones and so forth. But the agencies that we're talking about here are in the business of providing the computer networks, the vehicle fleets. That's what admin does. They provide the OET provides the technology, the purchases and the upgrades. They provide the telephone system. So, but by basically saying what's online is 1.4 and 1.5, it would basically shut down a major part of the mission of some of the agencies that we're talking about here. The second part, the out-of-state travel, is a different issue and, probably is an unrelated thing. So I do have some problems about the computer, telephone, motor vehicle and technology as it relates to the agencies within this bill. Also, on page 1.7, it refers to core functions of the agency, and I don't know how that would be interpreted. Obviously, the Department of Revenue is an agency, but we're also dealing with the legislature, the constitutional offices, and so forth in this bill. And I don't know whether they'd be interpreted to be part of that. So, the way that the language is, I don't know quite fits here. But I do have a problem with the first part, less so with the second part, except for the word agency.
Senator Foley?
Can I get a split on that and everything after?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to divide out on page 1.4 from the colon. Delete the colon all the way through line 1.5 and delete 1.5. So it would say that it may not be used for and then out-of-state travel, not directly, because, as I say, that first part, I think, is problematic for this particular bill.
Then do you want to eliminate the last sentence?
Yes. Yes.
Sarah Foley?
I would move adoption of the amended.
Okay. Sarah Foley?
So he incorporates it? Okay.
Whatever.
Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if we should say agency on line 7, agency or constitutional office or something like that, to be clear that we're not just referring to agencies that are not constitutional offices.
And I don't, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I don't know if that would apply to the legislative branch or not, because that's also within this bill.
We not talk to each other?
We'll find out.
So, Senator Anderson, are you?
Sure, I'll move. Or unless Senator Betzel wants to incorporate that.
Well, or Senator Foley is the maker of the amendment.
Made the motion, excuse me. Or constitutional office after agency, Mr. Chair? Senator Foley?
Senator Foley?
Would you care to include that?
I haven't any objection to that. My bringing this forward means that I'm trying to equalize the various state agencies and their employees.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson?
I want to raise a little bit of a dissenting voice to that, because the constitutional officers are elected officials and are engaged in a public policy setting, and they need to interact with other entities, and ultimately they're going to stand for election, and their opponents will bring out inappropriate travel.
Okay, so you're objecting to the amendment? To the amendment,
I'm objecting to including constitutional officers in there.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I'll just move that as an amendment then, and we can just take a vote on it.
Okay. So, Sarah Anderson moves or constitutional offices as an amendment to the amendment. So we'll have a vote on that first section. Further discussion? Senator Oebling?
I think that it's going to be really hard to define what is not directly connected with their core function when you're talking about a constitutional officer. I who's going to determine that? Because it's I don't know that their mission is written down somewhere very specifically like an agency's mission might be. And so I don't know who would determine that, except the constitutional officer themselves, for their division.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I think that's who would determine it. And, I think the alternative is just to say no travel, because we can't afford it right now. And this is a way of at least allowing some discretion there for the heads of these agencies or these offices to make a decision about whether it's a core function or whether it's something that doesn't need to happen, maybe, given the budget limitations that we're all living under.
Okay. We have Senator Anderson's amendment in front of us, or amendment to the amendment. Mm. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying, I'm sorry, Senator Pariseau.
I think before I know where it's being put into the bill, we don't have the reference points on this piece of paper.
Well, it's just a new section.
Senator Pariseau indicates page 11 after line 3.
Her mention is voting it in here, or agency in the, or constitutional office. That's all we're voting on right now.
Senator Pariseau, are you?
It's all right.
Okay. All right, we have Senator Anderson's amendment to the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Okay, then we have Senator Foley's amendment as amended. Do we have further discussion on the A? So we have Senator Foley's amendment as
modified.
As modified by Senator Betzel. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Further discussion or amendments on Senate File 2082?
I don't know if anybody else is here on the bill, Mr. Chair. I'm not aware of anybody else.
Senator Roebling.
Senator Betzel, I was just wondering, yesterday in your division we added the section about payroll deductions for union members, and finance person came and said that they hadn't determined if there was a fiscal cost to that or not by changing it from may to must, and I'm just wondering if anyone found out if there was.
I did.
Okay. Mr. Yoakum apparently is here, can testify to that, so.
Senator Pappas, did you?
Well, Mr. Chairman, he did discuss it with me that there was no fiscal cost, but if you want him to come forward.
Apparently, Mr. Lundin says there was the House had a fiscal note done, there was no cost.
Okay. Further discussion on Senate File 2082. Senator Betzold?
Mr. Chair, if there's no discussion, I'll move the Senate.